Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck Minster Fullers, what the fuck abilities? Merry Christmas, happy holidays. I know if you're listening to this when it's released, which is Christmas morning, I believe, you must need some relief. You must need some distraction from something, whether it's family or the fact that you're alone or the fact that maybe you didn't get the presents you wanted or you're taking a walk or it's just one of those sad, quiet mornings. Look, I get it, man. There's part of me that really looks forward to the holidays in Los Angeles because it really quiets down here and you can drive with very little difficulty on the highways. That's what I'm going to do today. I'm just going to hit the highways and drive. I'm going to drive the 110. I'm going to just drive it up and down. Then I'm going to drive down to the 101 and drive 10 miles in either direction. And then I'm going to drive the 10 all the way to the beach and back. With nobody on the highway. That's my plan. That's my gift to me for Christmas morning, to drive on the LA freeways with no obstacles, to drive on the highways of America like they were meant to be driven on, with freedom, not with frustration. Merry Christmas to me and my quiet highway drives. Yeah, I'm going to probably do that. I think that actually it sounds like a great idea. I don't know what you're up to. I do hope the holidays are going well. I hope that, you know, you're there amongst the wrapping and you've experienced some joy, or you've maybe watched some of your children break the things you gave them already knowing they would break it, or perhaps they love what you gave them, or perhaps you're now feeling a weird pang of sadness that your gift was not received properly. But the bottom line is this season is about opening your hearts, right? I mean, isn't that what we're told? Giving does not necessarily mean it has to be an object. You get it, man, right? You get it, right? It's not about shopping. It's about love, about an open heart, right? Look, or else it's just another day. It's vacation, whatever. I can't even wrap my brain around what exactly it means. I mean, I grew up with all this shit. I grew up with the, you know, surrounded by Christmas trees and Christmas carols and, you know, red and green and, you know, gingerbread candies and Santa hats and all that shit. So I'll tell you, it's a lot more appealing than the Jewish version. I mean, it's a lot more exciting with the lights. We have a festival of lights, but for some reason that festival of lights is not equal to the lights that are, you know, down on Coringa, which is a street a block and a half from me. And these two houses where these Mexican folks live are just they're in competition with the lighting in the holidays. And whatever the Festival of Lights means can't compete with those two houses down on Coringa in Highland Park. That's what I'm telling you. Much more exciting. Less heavy, you know, the iconography and imagery of Christmas than that of Hanukkah. Hanukkah, it was always like, you know, eternal flames. There were Maccabees involved. There was an ancient battle. You know, and with Christmas, it was, you know, this wizard kid was born. Some kings gave him some spices, and everything was changed forever. And that's why we have war. So, Merry Christmas! Oh, before I forget, I want to say that I put a bonus episode up on the WTF Premium. So, if you get the free app and upgrade to Premium, there's a bonus episode waiting there for you. It's me taking a tour of a record pressing plant, United Record Pressing in Nashville, and learning about vinyl. I learned some things. You could learn some things. So go get the free app, upgrade to Premium. I'm going to be putting more bonus premium content up as I feel inspired to do so. All right. So today on the show, Larry Grobel is here. Larry Grobel, and I don't necessarily expect you to know him, but he was the guy. I met him through a friend of mine. He's the guy that did most of the big Playboy interviews back in the day. This is a guy that has interviewed everybody. Everybody. The list is insane. Here's I'll give you a quick taste of the writers. Sal Bellow, Ray Bradbury, Truman Capote, Roger Ebert, Betty Friedan, Allen Ginsberg, Alex Haley, Elmore Leonard, Norman Mailer, Joyce Carol Oates, Bud Schulberg. I mean, those are just writers, actors, all of them. Ed Asner, Alec Baldwin, Warren Beatty, Marlon Brando, Jeff Bridges, Pierce Brosnan, Sid Caesar, Nicolas Cage, Chevy Chase, Rodney Dangerfield, Jose Ferrar, Henry Fonda, Harrison Ford, on and on and on. Actresses, Lucille Ball, Kim Basinger, Marilyn Chambers, yeah, okay, Joan Collins, Jane Fonda, Zsa Gabor, Meryl Streep, Barbara Streisand, crazy. This guy's interviewed everybody, so I figure why not interview the interviewer, right? Wouldn't you figure that? And when I interviewed him in two parts. What's interesting about Larry is he came to this gig much like I did. It was not the plan, but is where, you know, that's what we ended up doing, is talking to people. He wanted to be a writer of a different type, and he also wanted to write novels, which he's writing now. He's got an extensive bunch of books that you can find if you go to if you do a Google search on Larry Grobel, it will take you to a place, lawrencegrobel.com. Go to lawrencegrobel.com. And he's written a shitload of books. He wrote a very important and the book on the Houston family, as in John Houston, Walter Houston, Angelica Houston, and the son, I forget his name. He wrote a book on Conversations with Brando. He wrote a book on Al Pacino. But the point is that when he was interviewing people, this would go over the course of weeks, maybe months, for one interview. I mean, he spent weeks and like months with Barbara Streisand. He went to Brando's Island. I mean, what you had to do back then, back in the old days, crazy. So what I did to honor his style, whatever, for whatever it's worth, is that I did one interview and then I realized, well, he's got to come back just to try it his way. All right. That's how this is structured. So right now we're going to talk to Lawrence Grobel, Larry Grobel, about his extensive career as an interviewer for Playboy magazine and other outlets. And it's in two parts.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Parts. I was a little intimidated coming up on this interview.
Oh, please.
No, but like, you know, I look at, you know, you've interviewed everybody. You were the guy.
Yeah.
No, but you were the guy that did the interviews of everybody. How many did you primarily work for Playboy?
Not primarily, but people think that.
Yeah.
Because it's been a... I've done about 50 Playboy interviews and 50 television Playboy interviews, so about 100 total.
So the Playboy interviews were specifically the, like I was just recently interviewed by Playboy.
Right.
But not the 20 questions thing. You did the interviews, the Playboy interviews.
I did the big interviews, not the 20 questions. I did a few 20 questions.
But
it's a little different.
I couldn't find a Wikipedia page on you. I don't know how old you are. You look like you're 50, but you know, but given the who you've interviewed, unless you were interviewing when you were 12, you got to be older than that.
I'm older than that, yeah.
That's it?
That's it.
Yeah.
Fuck, man.
I don't get it. I don't get a number.
Oh, you want a number? All right, guess again. I won't be insulted.
62.
Okay, I'm a little older than that.
Really?
Yes.
Holy shit.
I know, and it's terrible because that's why you don't get work, because people think you're too fucking old.
You don't look old.
Well, what can I do? You should see my wife. She's Japanese. She looks like she's like 35, 40 years old.
Thank God
we're the same age.
Thank God it went that way.
Yes.
I didn't know where you were going with that.
No.
Yeah. But like, because I couldn't put it together when I saw you, when I met you, and I was like, how the fuck did that guy interview Marlon Brando at that time? How do you interview John Huston? How do you write a book on James Michener? When did he do that? When did that matter?
I interviewed Lillian Gish, for God's sakes.
You did?
I did.
But she must have been 100.
She was pretty old. She must have been in the 90s probably.
But like, I was intimidated because I don't like I'm hesitant to call myself an interviewer.
Oh, you are. You're a very good interviewer.
Well, I appreciate that. But when people tell me, it's like, oh, what do you do? How do you do interviews? I'm like, I don't look at it that way.
Well, look, you and I mean, what you do, you've done 400 or 500 of these things. So you already, and plus radio interviews you did before. So you know how to do it. You know how to talk to people.
Right.
That's really important.
Right.
I prepare probably more than anybody else. For instance, this morning I got an email from you. And it says, you know, do you have a list of your interviews that you've done?
Yeah.
And I went, oh, man, I do, but it's in paper. It's typewritten. I don't have it in the computer. So I got up and I typed it for you, you know, but I put it out.
You just typed all this shit today?
Yeah, I did it all today. So, but the point is, I have read your book a month or two ago.
Yeah.
I have watched your shows. I have listened to some of those interviews you do.
Yeah.
And I prepared questions. See, yeah. I write down actual questions.
For me?
For you. And I wanted to, we're doing this Saturday Evening Post and this, so I'm doing a 3-question thing with you. You're talking to me. And,
right.
and we'll have a good time with it.
Right.
But I prepared all this because that's how I work. I have 50 questions. I need 3.
But that's the proper way to work.
It might be the proper, but people don't do it anymore. I taught this thing. I taught the art of the interview at UCLA.
Yeah.
And man, you don't realize when kids come in, you know, they're 20, 22 years old and they want to do this, and I show them how I think you should do it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a 10-week intensive, 3 hours a day course.
Is it a journalism course?
I guess you'd call it that. It was in the English department.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of the students I did ended up doing, you know, I had one of my assignments is I used to give them go out and interview somebody who will help your career.
Uh-huh.
Because as a student, they'll talk to you. As a journalist, they might not.
Right.
So pick, you want to be a director? Steven Spielberg. Is that who you like? You know, whoever
Who's going to turn down a kid?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, some do, but the most don't.
Yeah.
So one day, I get one of my students says to me, you have any good restaurants you want to recommend in New York? I said, you go to New York? He says, yeah, I'm going just for the weekend. What are you going to do there? He says, I'm interviewing Tim Robbins. I said, Tim Robbins, no kidding. I said, what are you doing it for? He says, this class. I said, are you shitting me? He said, yes, I've been trying to get to Tim Robbins for Playboy for years. And he says, no. And he's going in and doing it.
So, as a student. Because Tim's a sucker.
And I said, sell the damn thing. You know, get it out. We'll find a magazine.
Is he tough to get? Yeah. Why? He's a difficult interview?
I guess he's difficult to get.
I interviewed him once live and I never posted it. Because we did a live event. I interviewed him in front of an audience. It was sponsored by somebody else. They asked me to do it. He asked me to do it. I knew him a bit when I was at Air America. They were a little, the two of them were involved. And after we were done, he wanted me to take out this part that I thought was the best part of the interview. Right. And I just didn't publish it.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I've had people ask me. I had Brando come to my house. I've had different people come and ask me to see this thing. You know, Streisand fought to see it. Brando did. I don't like to show anything. I think that's not journalism anymore. You're being a secretary. You know, it used to be the early years of Playboy, they did give it to the person. Sinatra, the interview, they gave it to him. He redid it.
Because having
stuff.
Him in the magazine was more important than...
And the Paris Review still does that. The interviews of the Paris Review are always given back to the author so he can go over it and refix it.
Yeah, I don't...
I never do that. So
I let people... If people want to sit on stuff or they want to take it, usually I have found that the only thing people ever want to take out of any of these shows.
Money.
Not money, when they say shit about other people.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like if it could be misconstrued or.
Well, Dolly Parton once asked me, you know, and she said to me, and I said, Dolly, I really don't want to let you see it. She said, I just please believe, I promise you, I won't insist on anything. And I really like Dolly, you know, so I brought the galley with me and I said, Dolly, here's the galleys, but I can't change anything major because it's already in galley form. She reads the whole thing and she says, well, the only thing I'd ask you to do, if you don't mind, she says, is where I talked about Elton John. I said, I didn't want to be like Elton John. Could you just put an "an" in front of Elton John? And I said, like an Elton John. I said, you got it, babe. No problem with that. I have no problem with that.
But how did you start out? I mean, so you're in your 60s now and you look like you're 50, which is good. But where you come from, Long Island?
Brooklyn and Long Island. I'm in Brooklyn for 9.5 years, then Jericho, Long Island.
And where'd you come from? Your parents were first generation?
They came. My grandparents were out of Russia and Poland. My father.
Me too. Yeah. We're like the same person.
Yeah. And I go to Poland all the time now.
You
every
do?
Year. Since 2007. I'm
oh,
on
for
the,
that the
so
cinema,
Camera Image Film Festival.
That was somehow,
that's a really good story if you want to hear it.
I will.
Thanks,
the Camera Image Film Festival, which somehow or another you created. You were responsible for.
I'm fucking responsible for. And it's 20 years, and it's among the 50 best film festivals in the country. But that's a story.
Yeah, but so, all right. So you grow up in Brooklyn and Jericho. Now, right. was the, how many siblings you got?
I got one sister, older.
Okay, so there's two of you. And what's your father? What were your parents?
My father was in the pharmaceutical business. So first, he was a sales manager. Then he became vice president of one of the companies.
And that's when he moved to Jericho.
Yeah. Well, Jericho, at the time we moved in 1956, it was the house cost $23,900. I remember that, $23,900.
Where is it now? Is it in your family still?
No. My father died. My mother recently died, but she sold it. She sold it for about $350,000, and now it's probably about $800,000 because Jericho's rated the top five schools in the country.
High school. No kidding. Yeah.
Yeah, they're always highly rated, so that's kind of cool. But I had a great time in Jericho. I mean, it was really you had your bicycle, you got out and you did your things. You had sex with the girls and
In high school?
In high school, yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah. In the 50s?
In the 60s. Yeah.
So it was starting to happen more.
Yeah. So the 60s we didn't have any dope in high school. I mean, that I didn't see till college. You know, I went to UCLA. But in high school, it was still, beer people drank.
When did you go to college? What year?
64 to 68.
So you're right at the beginning of it. Everything's changing.
Yeah, I was actually when I applied to college, I had applied to go to Berkeley, and I got in. And so I decided I'll make that decision because nobody in my high school ever went further than Michigan. So I thought I'll go to California.
Yeah, why not?
And that was the year of Mario Savio and the free speech movement in Berkeley. But at the last minute, I thought, I had an aunt and uncle who lived in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, it'd be nice. I'm going so far away. I may not get back home for a year. My parents didn't have that kind of money. You know, they said, if you go to California, you can't come home.
Right.
So I thought maybe I get a home-cooked meal once in a while. So I said, why don't I go to UCLA instead? So at that time, they let me do it pretty easily. I said, last minute.
For what were you studying?
I was an English major. I started in poli sci the first year, but I thought it was all bullshit. I worked for a congressman once, and
Congressman?
His name was Herbert Tenzer. He helped him get in, but Alan Lowenstein replaced him. So he got assassinated. But the congressman that was just a real learning experience. I was a writer for him when I was like 16 years old. But we helped him get in. The young people did door to door. We ended up in his office. And we used to meet with him, and he was the head of, I think, Barton's Candy. Uh-huh. So he was an older man. The Vietnam War was going on. Johnson's the president. We used to meet with him in the backyard, and we'd say, Congressman, now that you're here, you'll vote against the war. He says, I don't think I can do that, boys. I said, what are you talking about? That's why we work for you.
Yeah.
He says, well, the president seems to know what he's doing. I just got here. I said, look, you got to go. I says, otherwise, we're going to go work for somebody else to get you out of here in 2 years, which we did.
Yeah.
So, but we ended up going to Washington to his office, and I got to look through his papers, and file stuff. And I got to see how he got the nomination. And how he got the nomination was very interesting because at that time, the Democratic Party said, whoever wants a nomination, how much money can you put up yourself? So one guy said he could put up $15,000, another said he could put $20,000, and Herbert Tenz, I think, said he could do $30,000 or $35,000, and that's how he got it.
Yeah.
Think about it today.
So but he bought it.
Basically bought the,
It's a sad thing.
He still had to get elected.
When you're an idealist, and especially if you're a lefty idealist, it's a rough day or month or year when you get schooled on how it really works.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult thing.
It's very mind-blowing because I thought Brando really understood it. He was paranoid, but he had a right to be paranoid. He said to me, I said, do you really think that they're watching you and all? Because he says, I know they're watching me, he says, because I've taken Dennis, what's his name?
Hopper?
The Indian. Anyway, there was Russell Means and he brought them to his island. He helped bail them out and all. Dennis Means, I think it was. But he said that, he says, look, Larry, he says, at 12 o'clock at night, there are guys working on the phone lines. He says, who works at 12 o'clock at night outside my house? He's up on Mulholland.
Because he was a political activist for the indigenous people.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal. Yeah. And what year was that? Was it Nixon?
It would have been Nixon and it probably would have been Nixon in the 70s.
He looked at everybody. 70s, Nixon was crazy.
Yeah.
His abuses of power in terms of looking into people's business was in retrospect horrendous.
Well, look at
and he's very personal. He took everything very personal. John Lennon, he crushed.
Well, look at J. Edgar Hoover that's why he stayed in power for so long. I mean, why was he the head of the FBI? Because he had something on everybody. Every president, he's had it all.
That's how power works.
Power works.
All right. So you go to UCLA. You're studying English.
Yeah.
So what do you want to be?
A writer. I've always wanted to be a writer. So I was 15 years. I won a Newsday American History Contest when I was 15. I had to write about America's three greatest presidents.
Yeah.
I got lucky. I won. You know?
Yeah.
And the award was a watch, your name in the paper, and you get to meet the president of the United States, who was John F. Kennedy at the time, in Washington in June at the end of the year.
Yeah.
So each month, two more winners would happen with different essays. So there was a boy and a girl selected each month. So there were 16 of us who ended up going to Washington. And unfortunately, John Kennedy at the time is in Berlin giving his Ich bin ein Berliner speech.
I'm not a donut. I am a donut.
Yeah. So they got us to meet Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General. So we sat there, and I got to meet Bobby
Kennedy.
And
you're 15, 16 years old?
Yeah, I was just 16 at that time.
But what did
so that I saw it writing paid, basically. 600 words, and I'm meeting the Attorney General of the United States and possibly the President. All of a sudden, people treated me differently in school. You know, they announce you over the whatever.
Sure. It's a big deal.
PA thing. So, yeah. So, I still have the watch. You know, it's engraved. It was a nice one.
Was it always like you saw it as magazine or short pieces?
Never. I always saw it myself. Look, James Joyce was what influenced me.
You understood that?
As much as I could. I mean, I've written a book called Beginning and Finnegan, which is all about the search for Finnegan's Wake. It's a novel. You know, it's a fun thing to do.
So you want to be a novelist?
Yeah, I wanted to be a novelist.
And so you...
heroes were J.P. Donlevy, Saul Bellow, Norman Mailer, you know. I mean, the writers...
The heavyweights. You know,
yeah, and I had, you know, Dostoevsky I read when I was young, you know, so I had, I knew what great literature was.
The hardest
was.
Thing about Dostoevsky is remembering
the
all
names,
the names.
The names, they keep changing, you know.
Yeah, you got to keep going back, got to make a list for yourself.
Well, you know how this happened? I mean, I had a friend named Paul, and his father was a very famous bird artist, Arthur Singer, and he did Birds of the World and Field Guide to North American Birds, and I grew up watching this.
Yeah.
So that wasn't my father who influenced me, it was Arthur Singer and a pianist named Ted Harris.
The artists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and because this is a guy who worked at home. And he painted, and he would get the Museum of Natural History. He was the only person allowed to take out the stuffed birds, you know, have it in his house. And I'd see these eagles and stuff, and I'd watch him just draw them. And I go, wow, man, this
the
is
commitment,
a life. Smoking his pipe, just living at home.
So the life of an artist.
Yes, I really enjoyed seeing the life of the artist.
So you go to UCLA, and everything's changing in the world, and you're laboring over James Joyce books, trying to
portrait
crack the
artist.
Yeah, well, that's a little
Ulysses,
easier, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, Ulysses is impossible.
No. Finnegan's Wake is impossible.
Ulysses is
possible.
It's possible?
Yeah, it is. But you need the guide. You need the Anthony Burgess Guide to Finnegan's Wake or something like that. You know, that's
It's like reading The Sound and the Fury with the Clanth Brooks guide to what's going on. Those stream of consciousness things.
Well, you know, I just started reading Nicholson Baker. Have you ever read any of his work? Very good writer.
Yeah.
Ready to recommend. His first book called Mezzanine is a novel that is about a guy going up in that mezzanine, an escalator. That's it. The whole book, 160-something page. I've been curious about that book. So I got to know him. I met him at a signing for something else, but I've read his later books. I never read the early ones. And I like the way his mind works, and he's very original. So now I'm reading Mezzanine, and he does... You know, the way he does a footnote, but a footnote that is four pages long about a phonograph needle and a groove, you know, and I'm going, this is wild. How do you even read this? Do you stop mid-sentence to go to the footnote? Do you read it afterwards? But
that's
I love
his thing,
minds
though,
at
right?
work. Yeah, that's his, you know, David Foster Wallace did this in Infinite Jest. But it just that I like Gertrude Stein. I like, you know, what interesting writing. I like Thomas Pynchon. I knew I could never, see, here's where it fucked me up. And this is why I went into journalism. I always wanted to write.
Yeah.
I tried writing a novel. I tried another one.
What do you mean you tried? You finished it?
I wrote a novel, but I didn't give it to anybody because I didn't think it was good enough. It didn't compare to who I thought it was great when I wrote it.
Yeah.
But then a couple of days later,
How old were you?
17, 18, 19.
Was your first novel. You wrote your first novel when you're 18 and you decided shit.
Yeah, shit. I needed experience. I said, I need experience. So that's why I joined the Peace Corps. You know, and I went to Africa for 3 years.
To live the life of something to write about.
But I wasn't going in the army. See, that's the other thing I did is I avoided the draft.
By going to the Peace Corps?
No, they wouldn't let you out like that making a decision that if they took me, I was going to leave the country.
So you come back, you want to be a novelist, you got all this life experience. You didn't write the memoir for years though, right?
Right. I started writing this memoir. See, the biggest problem I had is I have a lot of stories with famous people. I mean, I've been with, you know, the Playboy interviews allowed me to spend 10 hours, 20 hours. I'd go to
Tahiti. But how does that, but how quickly, because obviously, look, as a guy, like I talk to celebrities too, and you know, you made a life out of it. But then I see, you know, after all is said and done, you know, you self-publish novels, you write these other books, like, you know, right out of the gate, I'm like, well, where the hell did that dream die?
Yeah, the novels never died. I'm still writing novels. But, I'm writing one now. But the thing is, what happened was, yes, you have to make a living somehow.
Yeah.
So what? When I came back from Ghana, I had a different perspective. I spent seven months traveling around the world after I left Ghana. 3 years in Ghana, and then you know I'm traveling around India and East Africa and Korea, Hong Kong and Japan and all. And I get back to the States, and I look at what everybody has, and I look at what people are doing, and I'm thinking, man, they don't realize this is the dream for every Ghanaian I knew. They want to come to America. They don't realize what's like. People are jumping out of airplanes, doing skydiving, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I said, no Ghanaian would do that. That's insane. You know, right. Why would you risk your life once you got here? So I had that perspective, and I was able to use that perspective.
You appreciate the bare essentials.
I appreciated life in a different way.
Yeah.
And so when I went to Newsday, I said, look, I can write these articles. I'll do stuff. He said, well, you know, what do you know about this? What do you know about that? I said, I can do it. Yeah. And anyway, I got a couple of assignments. And one assignment about the history of aviation on Long Island led to me finding out people were building their own planes. Some of them built it in their kitchen and had to knock down a back wall to get the plane out. Someone did it in an apartment in New York. They built a plane. How do you get, it's insane what was happening. Then I met a guy who was around Lindbergh's time. And he was fascinating. He had a whole museum in his downstairs basement. I met a woman learning how to fly, and then gliders, going up in a glider. So I did all. I went to the editor. I said, "Lee, besides this history, I could do this, 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 this." And they said, "Do it all. We'll do a whole issue like this." So I do. I jump out of airplanes. I go up in a glider. I get sick. The whole thing. I was doing this new journalism basically, right. All from my point of view,
like Gonzo.
Yeah, it was Gonzo type journalism. It was great. It was fun. And they were paying me $500 an article. I was living in my parents' basement. I had just come back from, I hadn't found a place yet. And I'm writing like crazy. 9 articles. I hadn't gotten paid yet. I didn't give a shit.
Are you 20?
22 maybe. Yeah. 21, 22. Yeah.
Living. You're doing things you would never have done.
Yeah. I'm doing transcendental meditation. My girlfriend comes from Japan, and she comes and we live together. We got a place in Brooklyn. She thinks I'm a dilettante because I keep getting into things for 3 weeks. TM. I said, TM, phone rings. I can't answer it.
At the beginning.
And I write about it.
That was the first wave of it.
Yes. But I still have that word, and I still do it when I'm on a plane and it's starting to go a little bumpy.
Oh, so
I use that. I lock into that.
But it's interesting. So you come back from Ghana with this appreciation of the extravagance of American culture, but you get the gig and you're like, I'm going to do it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why not? I had to do martial arts, people doing that. So I said, I take these classes. And
what
I do
is
a
it,
martial
1970,
arts
69, what?
I came back in 71, 72.
Okay.
72. So 72, 73 is when I'm doing all these crazy things.
So it's party.
I get strapped in a sulky to go around Roosevelt Raceway with the trotters so I can write a story about that. I go with, people doing demolition derby. I say, can I get in a car so I can feel what this is like? And I'm doing all this crazy stuff, and it's working. And the articles are good, publishing.
Right. So 72 is also like, the 60s kind of like, spread out into like just a complete change of the culture. Everybody's a hippie. Everybody's pushing the envelope. Right. Everyone's having, relatively drugged out good time.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So that's the environment.
Right.
Like the change had taken place.
Right. Right.
And so you're writing all these great articles. Right.
And then I decide I want to just write my novel. I just want to get into novels. That's what I want to do. So I'm going to move to California. It's 1973. A friend of mine who I knew in college becomes the director of Antioch College West, which is part of Antioch in Yellow Springs, Ohio, but it's out here in LA.
Right.
And he writes me, he says to me, would you be my assistant director on this? I said, I'm not looking for a job, man. I just want to come out and do this stuff. He says, I think you could be really good at this. I said, I'll do it part-time. I'll do it half-time. So I came out. And I started doing that for Antioch. And then I started, the minute I got an apartment above in West Hollywood, I got this place in a garage, over a garage. And I get the phone installed. The next day, Stan Green from Newsday, that I was writing all these articles, calls me up and says, we figured out a way to get off Long Island. I said, what do you mean? He says, all our articles are based on Long Island, but if we want to do interviews with household names. I said, okay. He says, yeah, so how about we'll do the first one with Mae West? I said, is she still alive? And she goes, yeah. I said, how do I get to her? He says, we don't know. You're the one in Hollywood. So I said, let me see what I can do. So I call up Paramount Pictures. I found, and they give me a name, a publicist or whatever. And I get to Mae West. And she agrees because people knew Newsday. So they would agree to it. Uh-huh. So I go to see Mae West. I wear a sports jacket. I go to a flower place. First interview with the celebrity is with Mae West. Besides this African I did for African Arts Magazine when I was in Ghana. But okay. Vincent Kobe. So I go. And I go to buy flowers. And I said, well, this is good for Mae West. And the guy says, oh, she doesn't like these flowers. She likes these flowers. Of course, they were the most expensive ones. So I said, oh, he must. No, so I bought them. I
sucker.
Go there, right?
Yeah,
and she comes out, and she's Mae West. She's got the hair, five inches high, and the wig on, and the high heel shoes, like a Dolly Parton before Dolly Parton.
Yeah.
So we go to sit down. I take out my tape recorder. I put it on, and she goes, "Oh no, you can't use that." And this is my first.
Yeah.
I said, "What do you mean?" She says, someone used that for once and they made a record out of it because her voice was very famous. I said, Miss West, I'll sign something that says I won't do that. But, I wasn't, No, she absolutely insisted I can't record it. So luckily, I had a pad with me and she spoke slowly. And so I was able, I'm writing everything and talking. Okay, so one night, that's my first one. I come back.
What do you open with?
Oh, I don't remember then.
No, but I mean, it's right.
She was the richest woman in the in the United States. She made the most money. She made $480,000 in 1932 or something, more than anybody around. So I, and then she got arrested. She did this very sexy show on Broadway.
Yeah.
And then the warden used to want her panties, that kind of stuff. It was like all these little famous things. So there was a lot to talk to Mae West about, and she was in Myra Breckinridge, and so. Could talk about that and what have you. So, W.C. Fields hated her. She hated him because he was drinking all the time. So there was, and also she had her secret was enemas and cocoa butter on her breasts. I mean, all sorts of shit I can tell you about Mae West.
But, and she just volunteered this?
Well, as I talked to her about it. But Mae West was this, was an interesting character, And so, but what happened was they get the article that I write. And the editor calls me up and he says, Larry, he says, listen, I got this Mae West thing. Listen, the next time you do an interview, use that photographer. Because he took a good picture for us. I said, uh-huh. Yeah, try to use him every time you do one of these. I said, okay, Stan, what do you think of the interview? Oh, that was fine. He says, but that photographer, use that. So I realized right away what's important in life. Right.
Right.
The picture. So, I don't care about the words.
Who was the photographer?
Rick Meyer, LA Times, who works for him.
You just called him? How did you get that guy?
Oh, he worked for the, they got him. Newsday got him.
So that gets you rolling on this thing.
Then I said, I did Warren Beatty, I did Jane Fonda, I did Cher, a bunch of these people, Carol Burnett, Lucille Ball. And then I started,
this is all in the early 70s.
Yeah. And then I said, you mean I can do anybody? They said, anybody? I said, how about Linus Pauling? They said, okay. I said, how about Henry Moore? They said, okay. J.P. Donlevy. They even said okay to that, although, I was really surprised. But what you find, though, is that there are only a number of artists, writers, people outside the entertainment business that are household names. Very few. And then you get back to your movie stars and TV stars, But I always fought for the writers. I always wanted to talk to, Norman Mailer and Truman Capote.
And you did. You wrote a book with Truman
James
Capote.
Michener.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, but that's how it started.
But they're more compelling, aren't they?
You see, Mark. Fully answer your question, but what happened was I started doing these things. They started getting accepted. They were interesting. Elliot Gould was a real challenge. I couldn't get through to him for a number of times because he was always a little bit stoned. And I'm going, Elliot, anyway, after five sessions, I send in the article, and they came back to say we can't use this. It sounds too stoned. That's the first rejection I've got. And I refused to have a rejection. So I said, let me go back. So I go back and I call Elliot. And I said, listen, man, they think it's time to do Stone. Let me come over. So he says, okay. So I go over there. And that day he has James Caan and these Playboy bunnies.
Yeah.
The girl introduces me, says, hi, I'm the popcorn girl. There was the cover of a Playboy with a woman holding popcorn with a hand down the popcorn thing. She's the popcorn girl. I mean, it's like, and Groucho Marx was there.
Yeah.
Groucho Marx.
Why didn't you just go, I'm going to interview him?
He said, we went to his house.
Groucho's house?
Belly and I went to Groucho's house.
So this is the mid-70s in Hollywood, so it's crazy.
Yeah, a lot of crazy stuff going on.
But when you, after meeting these people, I mean, because I've interviewed actors. A lot of them, not great.
They're hard to interview, some of them. Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, a lot of them don't have the education. A lot of them are insecure. Look, Al Pacino, you know, he didn't even finish high school. You know, I met him. He was so nervous. I get to his apartment, and he's, you know, he says, you know, and I see he's shifting like this. So I said, Al, and I go to put on my tape recorder. He says, no, don't put that on yet. I said, listen, just put it on. Once it's on, it's, you know, we can forget about it, you know. And he says, okay, you know best. The reason I got to Al is because I did Brando. This is all backwards now. But you know, he said he'll only do an interview with the guy who did Brando. I became the guy who did Brando for many years. And that's
Were you the only one or something?
Yeah. Well, Truman Capote did Brando during the making of Sayonara.
Right.
And Brando got pissed off at that article and didn't talk to anybody for 25 years. And then
you
I
were
get
the
it.
Guy.
Yeah.
Who sent you on that assignment?
Playboy. Yeah, that was because of Streisand. I had been doing these Playboy, these Newsday interviews.
Yeah.
And then what happened was I started thinking, well, I'm only asking them 30 or 40 questions. I'm only in there for about an hour or two at the most. What if I could really go deeper in this? What if I could really spend a day with you, 2 days? I got curious about the form and the permission. If they allow me to ask them anything, that's amazing. You know, I mean, I come in, I meet you, even, you know, on radio, we'll talk about things, but I'm not going to ask you about abortions you may have paid for or, you know, failures of sex or tax money you owed. I'm not going to ask you that.
That's Those are important questions?
I don't know if they're important, but they may bring out
they're
something
examples,
in you.
Sure.
I'm giving you examples of things you would never ask even in impolite.
In an hour.
But if you get into conversations with somebody for days, weeks, or months, as I did with Streisand over 9 months, you basically can ask almost anything, and you really get to know somebody.
Because you build a relationship.
You're building a relationship.
Are you still friends with her?
I wouldn't say friends. I would say not friends. I just, you know, I mean, if I see her, we talk. But I don't go to her house.
But you spent 9 months with Barbara Streisand.
Spent 9 months
what
with
year?
Her.
Wait, in the 70s?
That was my first Playboy interview, actually. When I finally realized that interviewing in depth would be interesting,
yeah.
I said, how can I do a long interview? Playboy was the only place to do it. So I said, okay, let me interview Hugh Hefner for Newsday, impress him, and he'll see what I can do.
That actually worked. Yeah.
So now I get, that Playboy says, what are you working on? I said, I'm trying to get to Barbara Streisand. This person, they said, if you can get to Streisand, we're interested. So I got back in touch with Streisand's people, Lee Salters, and I said, look, if you talk to me, Playboy covers the world. You know, they got 19 publications around the world. I can give a piece to Newsday. 350 people magazines around the country will do that. You can just talk to me and I'll saturate it. I don't hear back from Streisand for months and months and months. And then she gets pissed off at an article that Frank Pearson wrote in the New York Magazine called My Battles with John and Barbara about that. So I get a call saying Barbara Streisand wants to see you. Todd A.O. Studios. I said, okay, is this business or pleasure? And they go, just get there. They're really kind of curt. So I go there, and I'm outside waiting for her, and it takes a little while. And she finally comes out with her entourage of four or five people. And she says, and she doesn't say hi or hello, but comes right to me, nose to nose, and she says, why does the press hate me? First question right off the bat. And I just took a step back, you know, and I said, I'll tell you why I hate you. And I started to tell her, you know, you keep me waiting, you do this, you have to go through all your people, your manager.
That's ballsy.
Yeah, it was. But you see, I immediately recognized when I saw her that she reminded me of my sister, you know, this Jewish American princess. So I was able to zero in on that. You know?
Knew the language.
Yeah. So anyway, the five people behind her go, I mean, they are shocked. Nobody talks to her. And this is when she's as big as you can be, you know. She's making a Star Is Born at the time. So she looks at me for a second. She says, okay, come with me. And we go in the room and she says, I have to watch this, you know, the cut of A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
Sit down next to me. So we sit in these two leather chairs. We're in this big studio. We're the only people there. And I'm going, God, please let me like this movie. Let me like this movie. Because, you know, everything's going to turn around this. And I watch this movie and I don't care for it, right?
Yeah.
So, and I know, because I'm not a good actor. You'll see it in my face. And I'm thinking, what can I say? And sure enough, the thing's over. She turns to me and goes, well?
Yeah.
And I said, you're going to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And that was enough. And then John Peters comes and he's going, who's this guy? And he starts yelling, screaming. She introduces me and he backs away. So then she says, okay, call to my publicist, Lee, you know, and we'll arrange something. I said, no, I'm not talking to your publicist. I've been talking to your publicist for months and months and I can't stand it anymore. If you want to really do this, give me your phone number. I'll call you directly.
Yeah.
And she goes to a pad, yellow pad, and she writes B and she writes her number. She cuts off the piece like this and gives me a piece of paper this big with her number on.
Yeah.
And I call her and I go to do it. finally, that took more months. Now I finally get to do it. I'm ready to see her, all set to go. And she comes down the steps of in her home in Holmby Hills, and she gives me a paper. I look at the paper. What is this? She says, just sign it and we can start. And it says, Dear Barbara, and I look on the second page and signed by me.
Yeah.
And it's a big letter saying, you have the right to terminate this interview at any time. Once it's done, you can, you know, the, you will own right. the tapes. You will do this. Right. You will, and blah, blah, blah. I'll make any change. And I said, I'm not signing this. She says, what are you talking about? Everybody signs it. I said, Barbara, I'm not a secretary. I see myself as an artist the way you see yourself. If you can look at me that way and accept what I do as an art, then we can do this. Otherwise, forget it. Now, I'm not just saying it. I'm yelling. And she's yelling back. And we're sitting there with our fists like this, yelling at each other. And I said, I'm not your fucking secretary, you know. So she's... makes a determination. She's, you know, and then she goes, all right, let's do it. So we go in the other room to do it. Phone rings. It's her lawyer. Did he sign? She says, no, he didn't sign. She says, hangs up. Next one, it's John Peters. Did he sign?
Yeah.
No, he didn't sign. What are you talking about? Then Marty Ehrlichman, the manager, calls. Did he sign? And now this time Barbara's pissed off too, you know. So she says, no, he didn't sign here. You talk to him. And she gives me the phone. I hear on the phone this yelling coming out, I don't want to fucking talk to him. So I said, he don't want to talk to me. I gave her back the phone. Yeah. So she takes the phone and she says, I'm doing it. And that's it. She hangs up. And then we go sit by the fireplace. And within 5 minutes of me turning on the tape recorder, she starts talking about sex. I have prepared hundreds of questions. I don't have a single question on sex. I never thought we'd get to sex. I mean, you know, or if I warmed up, maybe later. I didn't write any now.
Right.
And I'm going, wow, what's she doing here, you know? And I realized it. She was committing. Because if I left, if all her lawyers and people told her, you can't do this anymore, she gave me material that I could use somewhere in the tabloid or something. Right. You know? So that was interesting. And
you thought she was that calculating?
Oh yeah, Barbara is very, very, very intelligent.
And no, I'm, but I mean,
she,
but
and, she, and yeah, I look. She told me a story. When I'm waiting for one time, I said, you know, Barbara, one thing I will show that's not right about you, because everybody writes about how you're always late. You got a problem. You haven't been late with me the two or three times I was with her. I was with her a lot. After I told her that, she was late every time afterwards, every single time, you know, so late was part of her modus operandi. But one day I'm waiting for her and I'm in the living room and I notice she's got all this, everything, Sarah Bernhardt letters, this, everything's beautiful, everything's expensive. And then there are two Chinese pieces that look like coral. But they're made of wax. It's like candles.
Yeah.
So I said to her one time, you know, Barbara, what I like, I said, you see all this real stuff about here, and then you see these candles, and they look real. And she didn't say anything. A couple of months later, I come by, and she says, oh, take a look at what I got up there. She got two real ones. Uh-huh. Amazing.
Yeah.
She was an interesting woman.
Okay, so now you make this commitment to doing these long-form interviews right. that you invest your life in.
Yeah.
So, like, in Streisand was the first.
Streisand was the first of that ilk. And 9 months it lasted. And Playboy kept saying, where's the, I wasn't even getting paid
But you call yourself an artist. What was it you were after? What defines the art of an interview?
Well, I think there's an art to biography. I think there are some great biographies that have been written. And I think the writers, Leonardo. But I was doing 30,000 word pieces that were being run in Playboy, that's 50 or 100,000 words that I'm actually doing. I was really doing books on all these people, but never publishing them as books. I never thought of it. I never thought of doing them as books.
So the interviews were framed in, you didn't do question and answer in a standard way. You would contextualize, you would add, paragraphs setting up everything. So, because the biographer,
biographer. That's like my Houston book. I talked to John for hundreds of hours, and then you write a book, you know. But so you're writing that, interviewing. It's a different kind of art form.
You can tell me honestly, like right now. I mean, you're writing a book on somebody with a career the size of John Houston. I mean, I understand that, but you know, to spend 9 months with Barbara Streisand for a 30,000 word piece. You don't think you could have done that in a shorter time? Was there some learning curve that you had, or did you just like building relationships with these people?
Well, with Barbara, I said something that you're very good, Mark. You see, you are good at doing this, because that's a good question, you know, about that. And it's interesting because there's an answer to it. And the answer is, because Barbara, she would drive me crazy, you know, I mean, because she just, every time I saw her, it was as she didn't trust me. You know, I mean, I had to regain her trust every time.
Yeah, but what you're describing is a relationship.
Yes.
I mean, what, ultimately, what
it is a relationship, absolutely. But so what I'm saying is, I kept saying to Barbara, "This is exhausting. Every time I come in here, I have to reestablish."
But you're like the Sunshine Boys. You like it sounds like
you fight, you argue.
Well, you created you was a very familiar dynamic.
Yeah,
you understood where she came from. You understood the language of, you know, middle class Jewishness.
Right.
You know, she represented that to this culture.
Right.
At that time, and you grew up in it.
Right.
So you know, I'm just wondering. It's obvious. I mean, there must have been something you were getting out of it other than an article.
No, but I said to her, this is what I said to her, Barbara, let me make a deal with you. I will not turn this into Playboy until you and I both agree we're finished, because I can't take this distrust every time I see you. Just trust me until the end, and then distrust me if you don't, you know, but I'm not, I give you my word on this. Now, had I said that to anybody else I have ever interviewed, I would have been out of there within the hour. They'd be finished. Thanks. Very nice to meet you. Barbara wasn't that way. Barbara took this interview as seriously as she took a movie, as she takes changing the tile in her pool. She changed the tile in the pool. I came there once. She had three buckets full of chlorine. And she says to me, "Larry, which gray tile do you like the best?" And I looked, and they all looked the same to me.
Yeah.
I said, "Barbara, the shades are varied." That I had to really look close, and I realized. She said, "I already took the tiles out of the pool once because I didn't like the way they looked, and it's summer, and she wants to get it right this time." This is an obsessed woman on a degree that you very rarely meet.
I know, but it's still funny to me that, you know, you...
And I had to do... I was committed to doing it until we finished.
I know, but it sounds like a movie.
It is a movie. I've written a movie called Conversations with Brando based on my getting to Brando, and Streisand's in it. It's a great movie.
And I haven't seen it.
Because it hasn't been done yet. I need somebody to do it. Anthony Hopkins read it and loved it. He wanted to play Brando. So did Rutger Hauer. He met with me, says, "If you ever want to do this, I'd like to do it." They're too old for it, you know?
But it's just interesting to me that, like, you know, you come out here, you know, you're a kid from Long Island who's writing for Newsday. You get this freak, opportunity.
Right.
And it becomes your life.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, you're...
My life is always a writer. In my mind, I'm writing novels. And that's how I see things. So this is an opportunity. I love this life, man. I mean, I was going into people's lives that you can't believe. I'd see George C. Scott at his home. And, you know, I'd go to see Van Damme, and he's in his pool. He says, "Get in the pool with me." And I put the tape recorder on my chest, because this is how I begin an interview.
So you're still jumping out of planes.
I'm still jumping out of planes. And it's been... My whole life has been... It's been fun. I've had a good time.
No,
you know?
I get
and
that.
So, and I've been able to get paid to do it. I turn things into books and novels.
But the juice of being in proximity to this, you know, what is the American equivalent of royalty on some level, and extravagance and sometimes incredible vapid shallowness,
right?
And you know that you're up against, you know, these major talents who you're the guy, and you know, and when was the first time you realized that there's no there?
I have never quite got to that point. Brando said to me once, "When are you going to stop interviewing actors?" You know, he says, you know, because, you know, after a while. And I said, you know, the thing, Marlon, is that every one of these actors is different. Everyone surprises me in some way. See, when I used to go in, I was always very nervous, you know, and I was always, and I had an image of what I was going to get into. And I realized nobody was like they were. Lucille Ball wanted to die.
Never. And you always assume that I have that same issue. It's like you have an idea of them.
Right. And they're never like they are.
Because your idea is based on their public image.
Right.
How the fuck are you going to know?
Exactly. So that's when I realized.
What was Lucille Ball like?
Lucille Ball was depressed. You know, everybody had died, all her friends. She didn't care for, she didn't see her children. She said, you know, she's like, "I want to die." She says, "I just want to die." I said, you know, I wrote a poem about it called, you know, "I Love Lucy Doesn't Love Life."
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I didn't know that. She had great legs, by the way. She came down the stairs. I couldn't believe it. But everybody was different. You know, I mean, everybody surprised. Sally Field tells me, never had a friend. Never had friends. I told that to Goldie Hawn. I said, you know, Sally Field says she never had friends. Goldie Hawn became her friend. They became friends. I mean, really, because I was interacting with a lot of these people. But, you know, look, with Goldie and Kurt, we got to be friends with them. You know, I mean, Al Pacino and I became very, very close, almost like brothers, you know, for over 30 years. I mean, you know, and so, I mean, how does that happen? I don't know. I don't know how. I mean, I realized friendships are exhausting with stars. So I would, when I felt one that could, you know, I said, well, this potentially could lead to something, I backed away from it. because I didn't have the time. Because I don't have the time. You know, you always, you know, if Al would call, I'd be on the phone with him for a long time. Marlon, I would talk to Brando on the phone. You know, we would just talk.
Well, how are you going to not?
That. Yeah, how could you not? Exactly. How could you not? But, you know, you don't get paid for these calls. You're not their psychiatrist. You know, you are their psychiatrist. They've done, you know, basically you're one of their therapists in a way. But, and I didn't get paid for it. So what I've done, I write books about it. I keep a journal. I have a journal that's got 20,000 pages, single spaced, since I started with Streisand, since 76.
Yeah.
You know, now one day that journal, you know, part of my memoir that goes up to my time with Brando, it's called You Show Me Yours. That comes from, a lot of it comes from the journal. But when you asked me earlier, I mean, talk about going all the way around in circles, you know, the memoir stops in 1980, but how did I get to write it? Because I felt guilty. I can't just write about my relationships with a lot of these people. You know what I mean? And I remember Truman Capote, how much problems he had with Ansett Prayers. And he said, what did they think I was? A jester? A court jester? I'm a writer. He hung out with all these people. I was in that kind of position. I was hanging out with these people. I was going to their parties. You know, with Al, if he was taking a bath, I could go upstairs and just, I didn't have to knock.
But how do you get to a point where, I have to imagine there would have been some, you know, crisis of identity.
Yeah, that's a novel I wanted to write about a guy who loses his own identity because he folds into all the others. You got to be a chameleon to be an interviewer.
You got to be a chameleon, but also, like, especially with the incredible neediness of some of these talents that you dealt with, is that, you know, it's very hard to fight the urge of becoming, you know, a lackey. Yeah,
yes, and I don't think I ever was, and that's why I've had fights with a lot of them. I mean, I've had fights with a number of these people.
Those are fights for your autonomy.
Yeah. Well, it's the idea of respect. You know, there's look, I go see Bobby Knight and he, you know, he's late at his house. This is after, you know, this is a big, big interview, Bob Knight, because this is after he's got thrown out of the university and everything. Uh-huh. And he's gone. And I'm surprised he's even talking to me.
Yeah.
And I go to see him. You know, and he's out hunting, and I'm sitting there with his wife in his house, and I'm waiting, you know, for hours, and he finally comes in, and he's not nice, you know, and he just goes, says, want to get something to eat? I said, okay, so we go to get something to eat. He orders, his wife orders, I order, in a cheap little Mexican restaurant.
Yeah.
He gets his food, he eats it, doesn't wait. She gets her food, she's polite, she starts to wait. I said, no, go ahead. My food came late. Knight wants to leave. You know what I mean? It's like, what kind of treatment is this? What kind of bullshit is this? I've done this with Robert Mitchum, where you walk in and he eats a sandwich, he eats his drink, he doesn't offer you anything. You know, they treat you sometimes like you're an encyclopedia salesman.
Well, but also, how do you avoid, you know, I mean,
that's the challenge, though. The challenge is to get them from there to respect me, and then to see how well prepared I am, and then I'm in charge.
Right. Respect you, or at least use you as a vessel.
Yeah.
Or at least have a comfort level to where, you know, it becomes an easy symbiotic thing.
You try. With Knight, it never came easy. He hit me. He tried to throw me out of the car twice. I mean, I had a lot of problems with
Knight. But how also do you get past the fact, I mean, obviously, if you're spending 9 months with Barbara Streisand and you're going to Marlon Brando's island and you're spending 100 hours with John Huston, you know, these are, well, Brando, maybe, well, Streisand too, but, they, you know.
And Huston, yes. One of the most interesting men in the world.
Well, yeah, but, like, I could see that. Yeah. I could see spending 100 hours with John Huston, but, you know, if you were, you know, interested.
Right.
But there comes an issue when you're an interviewer and that's your career, is that, you know, you've also got to fight the calculations of being used. You know,
but you're aware of that. You're aware that's going in.
Immediately. You
know, of course. The point is, what I try to do is get beyond all of that. Get beyond being used. Get them to talk about things they've never talked about before.
No, I get that.
And eventually it happens, but you need time. The only way this works is if you need time. You know? I mean, you and I, can cut through a lot of bullshit and talk very seriously because I think that's, we both appreciate that.
But do you think you still need time now? You know, it's like everything moves so quickly.
No, I don't need, no. But you don't get the time now. It's over. That's over.
But also people are more forthcoming now. There's a different language.
They might be more forthcoming. I don't know. But I don't know if it's that much forthcoming. I just think people don't say things because they do it on their own. They get out what they need to get out through the internet, through their own websites, through these podcasts, through, you know, doing an hour here, half hour there, getting on TV. The long interview that I did, I don't see that happening. It'll happen in books. You know, if you get someone to really talk and wants to do a book, you'll be doing long interviews. But the long Playboy, even the Playboy interview is only 4,000 or 5,000 words at the most. And it used to be 30,000
words. So then how does that explain your compulsion to spend months with people?
It doesn't happen anymore. That's gone. I mean, we're talking about a part of my life where I did that.
Yeah.
And it was fun. And I always said to myself, I always, no matter how much money I ever made, no matter how successful I might be in other forms, I always would like to do 2 Playboy interviews a year because I liked doing it. It gave me permission to enter a life that I can never get anywhere else.
So tell me about this time you spent with Brando. Ultimately, what, you know, like in any interview, like I don't really know what I'm going to get.
Right.
And I, you know, and my agenda is not to get necessarily something no one else has gotten or to get them to say something no one else has heard or they may not have said.
Right.
But my goal, because it's audio, is to at least engage in authentic conversation. And, right. and I think that resonates. So like the emotional impact of what I do is different than like, I can't look at this article, you know, Brando said this.
Right.
Because you can feel what we're doing.
Right.
So it's different.
It's different.
So when after all is said and done, when you have this life, I mean, is it as simple as that? You know, you spend all this time with Marlon Brando on this island. You're telling me all you wanted him to do was say something that hadn't been said before? Or was there something, you were looking for something? You must have been looking for something.
I'm looking for insight into the man. That all, every interview I do is what I'm looking for, is to show you what's beyond the superficial.
I get that. Like, so, okay, so
that's
you get
that. That's what I do.
But emotionally, and I know that's what you do, and you wait it out, and you keep talking. And obviously, you know, even in an hour, eventually people's guards drop, you know, in this situation.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. But ultimately, you must have been on some journey, you know, as a guy that, you know, wanted to be a novelist, wanted to be an artist, you know, you had to justify this undertaking that you were involved with as art, which it is, and I like the biography framing of it. I think that makes sense.
Right.
But what sort of truths, you know, did you ultimately, I mean, when you got Robert De Niro, George C. Scott, Henry Fonda, Jerry Lewis, Steve Martin, Robin Williams, obviously you're spending more time with some of these people than others, and you know, you've got this amazing list of writers. I can't even go through all the names. Some of these are probably shorter than others, but it seems to me that, you know, John Huston, Truman Capote, Marlon Brando, and Al Pacino were the guys that, you know, you did a lifetime's work with.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So after interviewing all these people, you know, what do you find is the common thread once you get through all that, all the bullshit? What do you find out about humanity? If you're an artist, you know, what are your conclusions?
That's a very tough question, Mark, to answer. What, you know, I mean, basically summing up, I guess my answer would be, I've written books about all the people you just mentioned. I've got a book out on, two books on, I got three books on Pacino. One is called I Want You in My Movies, because I was on his movie for Wild Salome. Yeah. I did a thing on it, and it's an ebook. I did another book that's out that he did an introduction to, which is a collection of all the interviews I did with him. And it's interesting to see the progression there of a interview that turns into a friendship, basically. That's what that is. And then I did a book called, well, I'm saying it for the first time here, but I wrote a novel called Begin Again, Finnegan.
Yeah.
And I took as the premise a relationship I have with someone like that as a novel. And I said, what if a major star killed the woman, the mother of his children, accidentally or not accidentally? What if he just did something wrong? What would he do if he wants to get an alibi? And I said, well, the best person to talk to do would be a person like me, a person he became friends with who was an interviewer. And he could, because you could do an interview at any time of the day or night. So what if he calls him, the star, and he calls him up, it's midnight, one in the morning, and he says, I want to see you. Okay, you know, I'll be over in a half hour, let me get dressed. No, I'll come to you. Why is he coming to him? He doesn't know. That's the premise, that's the opening. And then he comes and says, I killed her. Okay.
So this was a fear you had.
It's a scenario that has played through my mind. I've played through a lot of scenarios. I'm a, you know,
you're a paranoid guy.
It's fiction. I always say sort of these things. But I wrote a novel based on this. It was, you know, it was really interesting, and it explored me and my thoughts and whatever. Anyway, there it is. Now,
but the premise of that novel about you,
right,
is about, you know, being used.
Yeah, yeah, not just, yes, exactly being used, being this guy's alibi, and every fucking thing that goes wrong to the guy, not to him. He's the star, he's O.J. Simpson, he's going to get off. But this poor schnook who's done all this stuff, he's going to have
and
a big problem.
And this town is filled with those poor schnooks.
Yeah,
and the studios used to have those
schnooks. I'm one of those schnooks, man. That's so, the bottom line, I'm one of those schnooks, but I used my schnookiness to make a living out of it. And for a while, I've made a fairly good living. You know, I mean, if you can get paid 6 figures to write for magazines, that's amazing.
So you spend all this time with Brando at a very odd time in his life. you know,
he had just done Apocalypse Now, but I hadn't seen it yet. It hadn't come out yet.
So you spent how long with him?
I was on his island for 10 days. And then he came to my house afterwards.
Now, what did you come away with, you know, in terms of, you know, who he was as a man?
I liked him very much. I thought he was I saw him in a certain way as a hero. Look, I read his book, which is a terrible, I mean, he was sleeping with every, you know, friend's wives and all that stuff. I mean, he wasn't a good guy in a lot of, he wasn't good to his children. His son called me up, Christian, once he wanted to write a book about his father because his father was so bad to him. And I had a lot of conversation with Christian. Then Christian died at 49 of pneumonia. So I knew there were problems with a lot of what he did, you know, but I found him totally, totally interesting. I mean, we would go on his island, we would take long walks, we would go out on the pier. He would always have something like, if you had a straw here, how deep do you think you could go, you could take the straw, how many feet before you couldn't suck up anything? And he knew these answers. Now, he's 35 feet, he would say, or a fly would be out in the boat with us, you know, and he'd say, Cheyenne was there, you know, the girl who ended up killing herself. But she was 8 at the time, and Tehutu was 16. And we'd be out on this boat, and he'd say, how fast do you think we're going, you know, or how fast do you think flies can fly? And he says, well, they can only go about 15 miles an hour because that's what we're doing now. And he would catch the flies, pop them in his mouth, look at the kid, open his mouth, you know, and that would come to fly or something. But he had a thing that for your strength. He says, Larry, let me see how strong you are. And he would give me this thing, you know, and I would push and push, and the red button would go, you know, like a thermometer would go up to a certain point. And then he'd give it to Tehutu, who's his son, right? And Tehutu would for all the way to the top, you know. And he was a games player. He liked to play chess, you know. So I played chess, and I wasn't that good. So he could beat me. So then he would take a cardboard thing and put it between the pieces. And he'd say, okay, you arrange your pieces your way. I'll arrange mine this way, and we'll play like that, you know. Mm-hmm. So we did that kind of stuff. He was a practical joker. You know, one time I go to have dinner. Now, I'm the only person on the island besides his secretary, Caroline, and her kid, and Marlin, and, you know, and the workers. So the gong goes off, you know, and I go there, and I say, and I'm waiting 15 minutes, nobody shows up. Marlin comes and with Caroline, and he says, what are you doing here, Larry? I said, the gong went off, you know, it's a hollow-out log. So he says, oh, yeah, it's for lunch. So he turns to Carolyn and says, up you go. He had made a bet with her. He said the gong went off. She said it didn't. Then the bet was that the loser had to stand in front of me on a table and pat their stomach and pat their head and rub their stomach and sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow to me. Mm-hmm. So she had to do it. I would have loved her to lose. If I would have known that bet, I would have said the other way, you know, Marlin doing it. But you know, but he knew a sure thing, you know, he'd heard it. So anyway, so she gets up and she just says Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And she does the first verse and gets down. And it's funny for a second, but then it got a little embarrassing. And then Marlon says, no, you didn't finish the song. He made it go back up and do it, you know. So the cruelty was
but
there.
But it's interesting,
know?
That, you know, like, you know, in the face of all these, you know, having dealt with some, you know, Hollywood personalities at different points in my life and being vulnerable and being sucked in by the charisma of certain people, because some people are almost mythic, that it sounds to me that, you know, what must have driven you at some point was some sort of selfish need to know that, you know, you stood outside these people.
That and the challenge to do something better than anyone has ever done before. That was always a challenge for me.
But you must have had some spite for some of these people.
No, I don't. I wouldn't use the word spite at all. Only Robert Mitchum did I dislike. And that was because he was an anti-Semite. But, you know, other than that, I walked out on Mitchum.
But there was never a part of you that thought, like, you know, like, all right, so this is the big deal?
No, I feel like, sure. Charlie Sheen. I went to his house once, right? And I pull into it's a Malibu colony, and I pull in with my little, I had a Fiat, you know. And there's this beautiful black Mercedes and another one over there. You know, and I'm looking, I say, what has he got to deserve this? I'm driving this car.
You didn't ask that question a lot? Just Charlie
Probably.
Sheen?
but, you know, you sort of see this, and you start wondering. Freddie Prinze, I'm upstairs in his bedroom, and I'm looking at the bookshelves. We're talking in his bedroom, and there's nothing on the book. There's no books. I said, Freddie, where's your books? He says, I don't read books. I said, really? I said, I collect first editions. You don't read books? He says, what's a first edition?
Yeah.
Blew my mind. But so now I'm thinking, how do I reach this guy? How do I get to him? So I said, what do you collect? Is there, comic books and animation, you know, from the 50s or something, yeah. You know. Okay, let's talk about that, you know, and we'll go there, you know. You look for some kind of common ground.
No, I get it. But
some people are vapid, some people, you know. But everybody, look, I Chris O'Donnell, I interviewed him when he was 25 years old. Before he, you know, he did Scent of a Woman, but he's still new. So I'm talking to him, and I'm asking him questions, and he would say, gee, you know, my father could answer that question. That's kind of a philosophical question. I don't think I can answer. And I thought about that. I said, you know, I'm talking to people who aren't fully developed yet. You
that
know?
Happens, then, sure.
Yeah.
I don't find that I have spite. And what I've learned from talking to people is, you know, the human experience is what it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, people process what they're going to process. And usually there's an amazing story of struggle there. And I'm always moved by it. But it almost always, right. You know, even if somebody's difficult. But what's interesting, you know, to me in terms of how much you've done is that idea of, and I think it sounds like that novel sort of covers it, that, you know, really that, you know, you know, who's got your back?
Yeah. No, you, the only person that has your back is your wife and your kids. Nobody else. Nobody else. Not even your friends. I mean, my friends don't read my books, you know? Yeah. I mean, they want me to give it to them. They don't want to buy them. You know, I mean, this is the reality. If I had a thin skin, I'd never be in this business, you know?
But looking back at somebody like John Huston and knowing full well that, I mean, that must have been an amazing experience with Truman Capote, with Marlon Brando, Al Pacino to a certain degree. But Huston, I mean, you know, as time goes on, you know, that's, you know, that might be assigned in film classes. Do you feel like there was a futility to you know, to this mountain of accomplishment, to, you know, a lot of these people that you interviewed, like just like I do, it's like you got down at a certain time,
right?
And if they don't die, who the hell knows what's going to happen? What did you capture? What's the portrait?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's what I think I did do. I did capture them. For, I mean, look, I wrote a book called The Art of the Interview about all this stuff.
How am I doing?
You're doing great. But The Art of the Interview is used in journalism classes now. You know,
but that's, I've been told that I'm very unorthodox.
Well, look. You look for the personal in a lot of what you talk about. And I think, you know, you ask about your parents, your subject's parents, where they go back to. And that's, you know, these days you don't get that on television. You don't get that, you know, you don't get people looking for the mention a person, let's say, or, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever serious problems a person has, the psychology of a person. You know, like Roy Firestone was very good at this too. He did this with sports figures. They're the hardest people in the world to interview, sports figures, and he was able to do that, but he's not on the air anymore. He doesn't have a show anymore. Nobody wants that.
I don't know if that's true that nobody wants it.
They tell him that. He's trying.
No, I know that, but they tell us all that.
Yeah.
But that's
But you do your own thing. Right. You know, you've created a niche.
All right, well, give me some pointers that I can make me better.
I don't have any yet. Yeah, let me ask you these questions, though. If you could choose a career path and you had these three choice figures to compare yourself to, would it be Johnny Carson, Mark Twain, or Woody Allen?
Mark Twain.
Good for you. That's one I would have chosen. But that's very telling, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's like, where do you want to go? If you could be a talk show.
I wish I had the discipline as a satirist that he had. But he's ultimately a writer, but he became an orator and you know, was somebody who enjoyed speaking to crowds and doing a stand-up routine, basically. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he was an incredibly sophisticated thinker. I think that if I have any fault now, it's that I've really sort of rationalized my need to stay specifically within existential predicaments, either, you know, as opposed to sort of, you know, cast my eye on broader issues of political or cultural nature.
You know, John Huston once said to me, he was telling me about it, he says, if you think these people are cynical or whatever, he says, Mark Twain wrote a book, I think it's called The Mysterious Stranger. And he said, and as we talk about it, he says, Larry, let's go get that book. I feel like reading it again. We went to a store and got it. I loved him. You know? He says, this is where you just want to, you know.
But that was a different time where, you know, talents like John Huston, these guys who, they were boxers, they fought in the war. The weird thing about the culture we live in is that when you were doing most of your writing, you know, there were three networks. There was like four or five studios. You know, everybody was on the same page. Playboy had a tremendous amount of cachet, you know, on a literary level. And everybody was there. You know, that the people that were interested, the things that they were interested in, there was a common ground there. And there was a lot more.
Yeah.
You know,
well, because like, I remember Barbara said, the reason, I said, well, how come you're doing Playboy? She says, well, Playboy is the Bible.
Right.
You know, I mean, that was the way they looked at that, the interview.
It's a very interesting time now where you...
There's no Bible.
There's no Bible, but also this idea that, you know, people don't want long form stuff or in-depth things is that, you know, they've successfully leveled the adult attention span to something, you know, akin to a child. And that's the way that they're going to feed it because the hunger for content is so extreme. Right. I get on stage and people are like, well, I already heard that story. I'm like, you didn't hear it here. You didn't hear it on stage. I've told it two times in my life.
Right.
And already you want me to move on? I'm not a machine. I mean, so the credibility of authentic life experience or sharing on a human level has been diminished by this craving, almost an addictive-like craving for new content.
Right.
You know, you were going to, you know, there was a time where people had lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they did amazing, very prolific people that, you know, that fought in wars, that did things in a dramatic way, that aggressively, you know, like you said, you know, and you know, whatever inspired you to join the Peace Corps, you know, to get some life experience.
Right.
I mean, that had some credibility. No one gives a fuck anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't add up to much for people today. Mm-hmm. That the, you know, that life experience and wisdom gleaned from you know really living it, it doesn't have the premium it used to.
It doesn't, but thank goodness there's still a Peace Corps out there. There's still people who are doing it. You know,
I wasn't condescending to the Peace Corps. I was just saying
But it's true. I mean, you know, when I first started teaching at UCLA, it was 2001. And for 5 years, I told them about the life of a freelancer. This is the way to go. If you can be a freelance writer, not just a writer, freelance, anything you do, you have your own hours, you're your own person, it's a great life.
Yeah.
The last few years, I couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't talk about it because I saw you just, everything was drying up. You just,
well, you know, great writers because it's drying up alongside of the printed industry.
Yeah, that's right. The whole book industry that's why I'm a dinosaur because I'm still writing books.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, ugh. Well, listen, I know you have a 2 o'clock, so we went over that.
Yeah.
So I appreciate it. But I have more questions too.
Let's continue this because I do that. So let's pick up where we left off and think about stuff.
Okay.
Thanks, Wart. Okay. That was part one. And then I stewed on it for a month before I did part two to do it his style. So let's see if we get the full picture or let's see what happens. Well, see, here's the interesting thing about, you know, what we chose to do here, which is I am sort of honoring your style of interviewing.
Yeah.
That was my idea, is that, like, I sat and talked to you last time, and you told me that you would spend months with people, and in my brain, I was like, what could you, I mean, how is that gonna, you know, what, like, there's a couple of questions I have about that. Is that I'm a guy that does an interview in an hour. So what I have is I have the gift of audio is that, you know, you can sense emotion. You can sense, you know, where someone's at. You can hear their struggles. You can hear their tone of voice. So the portrait I'm creating is very specific to audio in a lot of ways because it's emotionally loaded.
Right.
And you can't do that really in print without, without elaborating. So in the sense that unless you're going to every other line, you're going to say he said with weighted, you know, breath or and it's still not going to be the same.
Right.
So the impact that I can have with an audio podcast in terms of, you know, who people are is easier.
It is easier. Absolutely. I mean, look, a really good interview, and you look at some of the best, are because their writers were really good. Truman Capote really captured Marlon Brando in a way when in The Duke and His Domain. Mm-hmm. Like Brando wouldn't talk to anybody for 25 years until I saw him.
Right.
That's a really good piece of writing.
You know,
I mean, if you look at that, so it's hard. That's why the majority of interviews are dry.
Right.
They're not that interesting.
Right.
There are a handful that are really good because the writer has somehow figured out a way to bring you, the reader, into it. So you get to feel the personality, get to feel the joke if it's a joke,
okay.
Or the sarcasm if it's sarcasm. Easier on radio because if I say a joke and I laugh, ha ha, okay, you know, we know what that is. But sometimes someone says something and it doesn't come off funny in print.
And also there's the issue of relevance. Yeah. Is that, you know, like, you know, like if I look at the list of interviews here,
half of them are dead.
Well, it's not even, but see, that's not necessarily an issue. But, you know, we live in a time where they're really, you know, context and history is sort of been obliterated. And certainly, you know, how much people are going to go, you know, dig up print interviews. You know, again, I'm looking at sort of this list and I'm trying to sort of frame this. And I know this was your job and you're very good at it. And, you know, all of these interviews that you've done with all these people are available, whether people go to them or not, I don't know.
Really,
and I think that the books, in terms of the history of film and the history of creativity, you know, these are important books, or they would have been the books you spent your life writing, you know, about the Houstons. They're huge. I mean, there's a resource there. You know, obviously, it's limited to you know, students of film and fans of that era in a way, so it's hard to figure out.
Well, listen, Mark, I do not write for an audience. In my mind.
No, I know, but I'm talking about who is the audience?
Who is the audience? I get that asked a lot. A lot of times when, you know, I've just finished two novels, and then the question becomes, who's the audience? Before anybody even reads them, right? Who's the audience? Is it?
That's an American publisher.
Yeah.
That's who asks that question.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But my, to me, it's like, I'm just writing stories. I'm just, you know, I guess my audience is me. It would be people like me, people who went to college. I don't know. I just feel that my job is to put it out the way I can. I'm not a stand-up comedian. I'm not an actor. You know, so I don't have great talent. I grew up, I watched Arthur Singer, the most important bird artist in America at the time.
Yeah.
And he died, but he and Roger Torrey Peterson were the two. And I grew up watching this guy draw his birds and being home smoking a pipe and just drawing. And I saw my father driving into, you know, work and driving back at 7 o'clock tired. And I said, do I want to do that or do I want to do this? I want this.
Yeah.
But I don't have the talent to draw, you know, and I didn't have the musical ability. I tried playing the piano for a while. You know, I just didn't have it. So I found I could write, you know, I mean, I could write stuff. And at 15 years old, I was writing stuff that was getting published. So, okay, there was my into the creative freelance world. And that's the path I chose. And thank God, I have made it all my life fairly successfully as a freelance writer.
Right.
You can't do it anymore.
But the interesting thing is that now, you know, you've got this novel published in Poland, which we'll talk about. But see, so that was the original idea.
Yeah.
So you're going to be a writer, right. And you are a writer. But now you spent your entire career talking to geniuses, many of them geniuses.
Right.
So you were, you have the same thing I have. You have the capacity to sort of connect symbiotically with a creative person, you know, build their trust, right. You know, however long it took you. I think I can do it quicker. If we were going to have a contest.
Yes.
But, you know, some of these people you talk to, must have had an impact. Now, obviously, you know, you're a fanboy like I am. And, you know, when you say, you know, Brando was our greatest actor, I mean, that's probably true. But most people don't have a real context for Brando anymore.
That's true.
And that's true.
Even when he died, which is really sad.
Yeah.
He didn't get the respect when he died.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people that happens to. It's not even that time passes them by. Sometimes what they become later in life, it sort of starts to eat away
at the
myth of who they were.
Because I interviewed Lauren Bacall, and I did James Garner, and I did Robin. You know, so the three people who recently died, you know, I said, gee, I was with all of them, you know. But Robin really caught the imagination of the world in a way that...
He was always there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like weird that, you know, his energy, like, I mean, that's a career thing.
Yeah.
I mean, Robin almost didn't age, and I think, you know, recently he has, and obviously his career was in a different place when he decided to take his own life, but the truth of the matter is the energy of Robin Williams was almost primal in a way. It was like archetypical. It was sort of always this thing. There was a vibration that he operated at no matter what. But like, you know, you talk to somebody like Miles Davis and you talk to somebody like Steve Martin, whoever, all these great people. But like someone like Miles Davis, I mean, you guys couldn't be more different.
Yeah.
And you couldn't come from a different world. And he was this cryptic wizard and you know, fairly opinionated and kind of wrong minded in some ways. But you know, about women and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've dealt with that. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you just have to not argue with them and then let them unfold.
Right.
And that's the honesty of it. But when you talk to these geniuses, as somebody who secretly is harboring this desire to write a novel, what are you thinking? What did you learn from them?
What I was thinking with Miles is damn, I made one huge mistake by not asking him to write his biography, his autobiography.
Sorry,
I wanted to write a bit more. I wanted to spend more time with him. That's, I mean, he was amazing.
Yeah.
The guy was amazing. He sat there for 3 hours. I have it all on video. We did it for cable TV.
Uh-huh.
He spent the whole time, he had the, all these, he was drawing, you know, he had all these colored pencils and stuff like this, and he would be drawing and stuff, and never would look up, and I'd ask him stuff, and the cameras are on him, and he's talking about race, and he's talking about feeling uncomfortable among whites, and he's talking about strangling a white man, all that shit, you know, and it was great.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and he was kind of, he made me laugh, even though he was saying things like, I don't want to go to a movie because I see some white girl have fun in a movie, or what, and he says, you know, I want to, you know, and he's just, my wife, you know, can't get a job, you know, and he's talking about Cicely Tyson.
Cicely Tyson,
you know. So I just found... Perhaps one of the, I mean, he is the Brando of the music
world.
I mean, but you know, Miles Davis was really important, like Pavarotti was. I mean, I've had a great life in talking to these people.
Yeah.
You keep wondering, what the fuck am I doing talking to these people? Or why do,
what do I
get out of it?
I know a lot
out of it.
Yeah, of course.
If I didn't get a lot of it, I wouldn't be doing it.
Of course.
And I miss doing, I haven't done the Playboy interview in a few years because the editor doesn't like me anymore.
Same guy.
And it's a terrible situation.
My Playboy interview, they got a fact wrong.
Yeah. Well, I could see that, you know. Their interviews haven't been that good lately. I mean,
how do you just make up facts? What happened to fact checking?
Good question. It used to be something you could rely on. Nowadays, especially book publishing, they don't fact check. I mean, I have books coming out and I see stuff, mistakes. Oliver Stone called me up and said, you got my Academy wrong. You know, which I got it for. I said, oh God, I'm so sorry, Oliver. But what the hell is it? That's a fact checking thing that should have been done.
That's right.
But I can't rely on that.
Was there some through line to the creative spirit or to people that capture the public imagination that you were able to identify?
Well, I try to, you know, I don't think that way. So I don't, I'd have
but
to
you've
really
had time
think
to
about
reflect, Larry.
Yes, well, but that's what, but yes, the through, look, I put a book out called Icons.
Okay.
I took 15 of the people that I think are, that we can legitimately call icons. Maybe not, what's her name? Paltrow, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Right.
I think she's an icon. But I put her in the book because I wrote about it and I just...
Yeah.
But Meryl Streep's in there, Robert De Niro, Jack Nicholson, Tom Waits.
Uh-huh.
You know...
You interviewed Tom?
No.
I can't get him either.
I love him. I love Tom Waits. So I wrote it. I wrote an article as if... You know, how to figure out how to write that one? That's the only one I've ever written like that where
I'm talking to him. So how did you do it?
Well, there's a thing called esoteric tours in L.A. And I saw that one day I saw something in one of the like L.A. Weekly. It said that they're going to do a Tom Waits tour, you know, where Tom grew up and what he did in L.A. So I got in touch with them. I said, listen, I'm interested in writing a piece on something. And they said, oh, yeah, come on to that. So I got on the bus and I go on this tour. Okay, that gave me my idea to write the article.
So what, you go to Cantor's?
Yeah, basically, you go past Cantor's, on Hollywood and Las Palmas, there's a place,
this is a tour based on Tom Waits' life.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the guy who talks about it wrote a book about Tom Waits or something. You
uh-huh.
know? So he's on mic and he's talking about
uh-huh.
stuff. So I said, okay, I can start a thing where I'm going to go do this. And then I can have people on the bus arguing about his stuff, you know. And so I make up these people and I give you all my opinions about Tom Waits through their voices.
People.
It was just so much fun to write. And they liked it. They put it on the cover, right? And,
yeah.
And now I'm putting it out in my book called
Did you
Icons.
Hear from Tom?
No, I
Where can
I
people
did.
Get your books?
They got to go to Amazon.
Yeah, and look under
Lawrence Grobel.
Lawrence Grobel.
Right. And that's it.
Okay. Yeah. But okay, still, I'm not getting the answer I want from you.
I know. You can't get my answer. And I don't know why I can't
the
get
answer
it to you.
Is that you're a creative guy that has taken this long to sort of manifest, you know, what you really wanted to do because you it wasn't a detour, it was a living talking to creative people.
Right.
Was there anything you learned?
I learned how to live a life. I've learned how to be a person. I learned how to
There's
communicate
no philosophical
with people.
Gems.
No.
There's no sort of like one
oh,
of them.
Well, that's different. You're saying, okay, what were the main things I learned from certain people? I had four mentors, right? I would say. Bernie Wolfe was one of them. He was a novelist. He was at UCLA. I got to be one-on-one with him for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
So I'd never had to take a class. And I gave him the ending of a novel called Lies at one time. You
uh-huh.
know, we used to meet in his place, and I used to watch him smoke his cigars and all that. And
yeah.
And we talked about literature. And he always had people over and
uh-huh.
stuff. Alex Haley. I remember when that book was coming out, there was a lot to talk about that and stuff. I lent him money while I was a student. Yeah. You know, he never paid me back. And then I once asked him for the money, and it was $500, and he gave me back $200. Uh-huh. And then I hired him once. He fucked me over. I hired him.
This is your hero.
Yeah. No.
What is your hero?
I've learned, man. You learn that with certain people, who they are, not necessarily what you're reading. I don't know if James Joyce and I would have been close friends. Right. I don't know. But he probably is. It was a real bastard. Mm-hmm. But, listen.
So that's one thing you learn is that sometimes, the public image or the image that you have as somebody who is enamored or taken with them can very easily be diminished.
Yes, and it happens all the time. Al Pacino Al Pacino and I are very close for 30 years. We had a falling out, so now we're at a distance of each other, and I realize that he cannot apologize. It's because it's not in the star's gene mm-hmm. to be able to apologize. And I knew this for a long time about these people. I learned this about stars. They don't, no matter how wrong they may be. And one time, Anthony Hopkins, who was going to do a script of mm-hmm. mine, based on the conversation with Brando book, and he was excited about doing it. Mm-hmm. And then we even met, and his agent at the time at CAA, he was going to be my agent. Everything was really going nicely, and all of a sudden, I get a call from the agent, Rick Nocita, saying, Tony's going to back out of it, he doesn't want to do it. I said, why? He says, he's afraid. He's afraid to play Marlon. I didn't believe it. I said, this guy has played Picasso, he's played Hitler, he's played some of the presidents. I mean, Nixon, Hopkins is an amazing actor. He was afraid. So I said, I don't think that's probably the reason, but okay, and I felt bad. I never showed it to anybody. Pacino said to me, he'll come back. Don't show it to anybody. He'll come back. So I didn't do anything. He goes off and does the Wolfman Hopkins, and he mm-hmm. comes back. And then one day I'm home, and I get a phone call.
Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
I said, hi, Tony. How are you? And he goes, Larry, he says, listen, I did a terrible thing to you. A terrible thing. I'm just so sorry. I said, that I didn't call, and I didn't tell you why. I didn't want to do the Brando thing. I just held you up, and I led you on. And I'm thinking, this is impossible, right? It's impossible. Anthony Hopkins cannot be apologized.
Right?
Because it's against everything I have learned, with the stars. And then I'm thinking, he's interested in the script, but he doesn't want to say it because it's been up over a year. So, so I said, Anthony, I haven't shown it to anybody since.
Yeah.
Oh, really? No, I wasn't calling about that. I wasn't calling you about that at all. Okay. I said, okay. He said, but let me give you my cell number, and why don't we have lunch? Let's get together. I said, terrific.
Yeah.
So he gives me the number, and I wait a little while, and I called him, and we meet. We meet for lunch. And it's all about Brando. It's all about the script and all. Okay, that's, a story you learn about, apologies in a sense. So I find that a sincere apology doesn't exist among stars. That's one of the things I'm sorry to say, but, it's a rare thing.
But also, doesn't that also put into question that sometimes, no matter how much time you spend with these people, or no matter how much they reveal to you, does not necessarily that you have an emotional relationship with
that
person.
And I think I do. And I often don't.
That's right.
I'm fooled over and over again.
That's right.
Goldie Hawn and I and Kurt Russell, because of Goldie, were very close. Shared dinners. We went to dinner at her house. She would come to our house and everything.
Yeah.
And then what happened was, God, I'm telling you stories.
Yeah.
That I don't know if I should be talking out loud, I guess. But,
right.
But Entertainment Weekly asked me to do a cover story on Kurt Russell, and I did. And and Kurt and I had a great time. We went out and flew in his plane. And at one point, he gave me the controls. He says, "You fly, I'm going down. I can't do this." But he's laughing. So we had a good relationship, and it's going to be a positive article about him, whatever. So I write the article and give it to Entertainment Weekly. Now, Entertainment Weekly is part of Time Magazine, mm-hmm. which means that they go through editors. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 editors sign off. An editor who just signs off without putting his 2 cents in isn't making money in his mind, isn't doing his job. His job is he's got to find something. So you got 5 editors finding things throughout this story. And it comes back, and then they send me the galleys. And I looked at the story, and I said, this is not what I wrote. I said, it's another story. I don't want it. I said, go back to what I wrote. Show me why what I wrote is no good. So they go back, okay, and we change things back and forth. But this is, timely because something's going on. Okay, so now I didn't see this is the second galley after that. The article comes out, and it's a decent article, but it cut out a lot of nice little things between us. But on the second paragraph, it said that Kurt Russell, who's looking to become is a B actor looking to become an A actor, something like that. A terrible line. I didn't write that. I didn't write that whole paragraph. Okay. And I felt, oh, well, Kurt's going to call me up and bawl me out, and I'll just have to tell him I didn't do it. Well, instead, what happened was we lost contact. I never heard from them. And then it was our time to have dinner. I called her, you know, left a message, didn't call back. I called again, didn't call back. So I said, well, something's happened. My wife says, we had stayed at their Malibu house once with our kids.
So you're real close.
Yeah. So, but I forgot the password to get in. So I had to, the people came and I said, and I think it was some kind of animal. So I got close enough that they said, okay. So my wife was saying, maybe you just screwed up their alarm system and said they're mad at you. I said, no, that doesn't make any sense because we got it. You know. So I said, maybe it was the article, but nah, it's too petty. It's only that one paragraph, right? So I don't hear anything. Then half a year go by maybe. Al Pacino, who did not know Goldie or Kurt, ran into them at the Oscars or the Emmys or whatever it was. And he's just talking to them. And he came back and he and I were having lunch. He says, oh, I saw a good friend of yours. He says, at the thing. And I said, well, I says, you know, yeah, I said, Goldie and Kurt. I said, well, they're not really friends anymore. I said, what's the matter? What happened? I said, I don't know. I said, for some reason, they're not getting back to me. So something went wrong. But and it was Al who said, I want you to write. He said, you can never leave something like this unexplained. You have to come to a conclusion. If you did something wrong, find out about it. If you didn't, whatever. So I want you to write her one more time for me. I said, I'm not doing it. He says, no, write and say in the opening line, Al told me to write this or else I wouldn't be writing. Whatever. So that's what I did. I wrote one more time.
To Goldie.
And Goldie writes me back and she says, I have to tell you, she says, that the person, she's, I thought that we had such a good relationship with my wife, my kids, the whole thing. And then I saw that, you know, the article that you wrote and the person that you were writing about, Kurt, was not the person I was living with or the person I knew. So if you could be so off on that, then I didn't know what to say. So, you know, we just dropped back. And I said, Goldie, I wrote back to her. I said, Goldie, this is like a Guy de Maupassant story because it's like the necklace, you know. I said, I sent the 17-page article that I had written in manuscript. Mm-hmm. I sent it to her. And I said, I want you to read the article. And I also made a copy of the piece because I figured she probably wouldn't have it. I said, look at the two of them. Okay, so I do. And the piece was really very favorable about him. Yeah. So anyway, she writes me back another note, and she says, I'm down on my knees in apology. I am so sorry. She says, what you wrote is so beautiful, and why don't you come for dinner? And, you know, whatever. So I said to my wife, do you want to go? She said, yeah, okay. So we go. And, you know, at that time, Kate wasn't acting yet. Yeah. You know, she was so small. Yeah. You know, she needs to sit around the table. So we go, and Kurt says, well, I guess we, you know, he brings it up. And I said, Kurt, let's have dinner first. Let's have a nice dinner first. Because I got a lot of things I want to talk about, too, because it's the nature of friendship. To me, what it was I thought we were friends. Yeah. If I did something that upset you, why don't you call me on it? That's what a friend would do. Why did you write that? And I would say, I didn't do it. I'm sorry. I had no control over that. So we had a very nice evening. We had that whole talk and everything.
Yeah.
But what really happened is we don't get together anymore. Yeah. Once it happens, it happens. You know what I mean? There's a cut. I ran into her somewhere else in front of CEA once, and we just hugged and kissed, and everything was terrific, but we haven't seen them. I'd like to, you know, but I haven't gone out of my way either, you know?
Well, sometimes, you know, life gets in the way.
You know, here's a really interesting one.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton.
Right.
Dolly and I got along famously. We did a great, you know, they came out in Playboy in the 78 or so, what, 79? One day, Playboy thought they could get to Charlie Manson, and they called me up. And they said, Larry, we want you to consider this. We don't want you to answer yet, but I want you to consider doing Charlie Manson. I said immediately, why wouldn't I do it? He says, well, you know, you live up in the hills where that happened. You just had a baby. and there are still some crazies out there in the members of the family, and it might, you know, so it might be something you want to discuss with your wife about doing first. And that's interesting, because I never would have thought of that. I wanted to do Idi Amin once, and nobody would let me because they thought that he would kill me. So there I am thinking about it, and I call all the guys I knew, said, you got to do it. You got to do it.
Yeah, of course.
Larry Schiller, who had got involved with Squeaky Fromm once or something, said, he says, yeah. He says, I said, anything happened with you when you were involved? He says, yeah, they blew up my mailbox. I said, Larry, they blew up your mailbox? He said, what, been to the house? Yeah. This is where he's coming from, right? So I'm thinking, okay, every woman I knew said, don't do it, right? Yeah. Stay away from the energy. Okay, so it's a Saturday night. I'm thinking about doing it. You know, this is where my head's at. I'm going to call on Monday. Phone rings out of the complete blue, because I don't have this kind of relationship with her, but it's Dolly Parton.
Right.
Hey, guy, how you doing? I was just thinking about you. She goes, you know, I said, you know, what you been up to? I said, Dolly, it's funny that you called now. I said, I'm making a decision. And what's you thinking about? And I said, well, you know, they asked me to do Charlie Manson. What? She says, hold on, stop this thing. If you see him, if you talk to him, if you have anything to do with him, I will never talk to you again. That has nothing to do with your decision, she says. I just want to tell you, be upfront about it. That man has got bad energy, very evil. You're very sensitive. His evil will get onto you. I don't want that to get to me. I have nothing to do with you again. So I said,
she's right.
God, Dolly, I think you just made up my mind for me. So I said, I said, I didn't do it, you know, but what happened? I didn't see Dolly for 3 or 4 years. And then I got an assignment from like McCall's or something to do Dolly. And I said, great. So I meet her in a French restaurant and you know, she hugs me. It's like we're old friends. And I said, Dolly, I said, why haven't I talked to you in the last 4 years? She said, and she looked at me. I said, it's Manson, isn't it? She said, yes. She says, just that you considered it put me off about you, because you just even considered. I said, but I'm a writer. This is an assignment. I said, I would do Hitler. I would do, you know, Mussolini if I had a chance to get to him. But, you know, this is another thing. Is this what I learned? Yeah, I learned how to deal with people through life, but I'm never right about it. You know, I mean, it just, everybody surprises me. And that's another thing. I used to really think, what was Warren Beatty like? You know, what was it? You know, and so, if they throw you, if they come in with somebody else, well, with a friend, or if they just something else happened, it's a different person.
No, you can't.
So I've just realized that these people are different. They're all individual. They all have their own, you know, quirks. Some of them are very depressed. Some of them aren't. I like to be, my challenge is just to get to them. You know, the fact that I could get to Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
And to get to, you know, Linus Pauling or Joyce Carol Oates, you know, or Norman Mailer. I mean, it's fascinating to me to be able to try to get into their minds.
And, what's interesting, you know, because that dynamic is that, you know, they are who they are because of their, you know, of their work, but also because they've been celebrated somehow and they're cultural icons and they've done something amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, what drives me and that might drive you on some level is, it's compelling to be close to this power, but it probably reveals some fundamental insecurity on behalf of yourself.
No. I don't feel insecure. I accept the fact that they are more talented, let's say, in their field than I am.
But you want to be a writer, and you're like, there's something that you
I don't want to be a writer. I am a writer.
All right.
I've been writing for 50 some years.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to insult you.
Not an insult. That's okay.
You are a writer. Yeah. But I'm saying, in this process, you know, you want to write novels. All right. And it's just in my mind, I know, you know, I know the thrill of being close to, you know, to famous people.
Right.
And you know, no matter how much you want to humanize them, it's still daunting and it's still exciting. And, you know, as a guy that's going to go in there and have this access and then sort of figure out where they're coming from and how they're doing and develop this relationship and where they are emotionally and why they are who they are, that's a powerful position.
I guess it is, but I don't do you.
But you
the
have.
Power.
I guess my point is that you have been hurt, you know, by, you know, the assumption that you had relationships.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and listen, but then I write about it.
The thing is that you know, you survived through all this, and I think what's interesting is that you know, it's a challenge now, but conversely, you're actually doing exactly what you wanted to do.
Exactly.
Now.
Finally, you've come to realize that. I have been doing what I wanted to do my whole life. I have always felt like somehow I've never worked. Mm-hmm. I've worked hard, yeah. but I've never worked because I loved it. I loved when I interviewed Mae West the first time, my first love. I loved when I got to Truman Capote. I mean, who? Yeah. Saul Bellow. Sure. I'm going to talk to Saul Bellow. I read this guy when I was, in my life. Right. It's so wonderful. You're doing it. You don't hate it. You love it.
I know, but you know? See, there's still that thing, like, I want to write and play music.
But you've written a book. Well, that's different. Music is a different story.
I want to be, I want to do in comedy that some part about living your life through other people, even if it's interviewing, as compelling as it is, that there's some part of you, and I can hear it in the way that you talk about your acceptance in this country, that it's not the interviews that you want to be necessarily known for. That was your job and you had a great time.
Right.
But now you're writing books.
Exactly. But you're on TV. You're doing your show.
You're right.
You're all right. I can't believe every time I turn on your podcast, it says, hey, folks, I'm going to be in here. I'm doing this.
Finally.
I go, what the hell? He's all over the place. He's in the magazines now.
Took 25 years.
All right. Well, hey, listen, it can be 40.
But you were making a good living before.
I'm making a decent living, yes.
You were all the way through it.
Yeah.
Not me so much.
Yeah.
So now, okay, so let's do business.
Yeah, okay.
You all right? So if they Lawrence Grobel is where they can get your books on Kindle. Do you have a website?
A website, lawrencegrobel.com.
Because I think it's a tremendous resource. And I have a lot of respect for what you've done and what you do. I do. And I'm glad that our friend Janine put us together because I wouldn't have thought of it. And I was resistant at first.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
It was great talking to you, Larry.
You too.
I guess I could go for weeks. I could interview him again. I'm sure there's no end to the stories, perhaps. Perhaps there's one day I'd get to the truth of whatever I was looking for with Larry Grobel, which was, how he really felt about having that proximity to celebrities. Like, I didn't feel like I got deep enough with him. Maybe that's why you got to interview somebody over and over again. Maybe not. So Merry Christmas to you, and happy holidays. I just put up a bonus episode on the What WTF Premium app. So you can go get the free app, upgrade to premium, get that bonus episode where I took a tour of a vinyl pressing plant, a record pressing plant. Anyways, have a cookie. Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.